All right, so our 11:30 matter is Kevin Sanceri versus State of Nevada, case number 81551. And I think you guys are both familiar with our procedure, but just to make it clear, you each have 15 minutes. If you're going to reserve any time for rebuttal, you can tell us that, but all that will mean is that the yellow light will go on and there'll be a tone when we get to that point, but the clock will keep running, and it's up to you to step away and save some time for rebuttal if that's what you want to do. And on your argument, I'm sure you're familiar with it, you'll get the yellow light when you're down to 5 minutes.
Thank you.
All right. Are you ready?
Yes.
All right, let's go ahead. And yes, you can remove your mask when you're arguing, even though we require it in the public hallways. We also wear them in the public hallways, but we remove them when we're here on the bench together, knowing that we're both vaccinated and keeping our distance. Go ahead.
Morning, Your Honors. Damian Sheets on behalf of Kevin Sanceri, the appellant in this matter. If I could respectfully request 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
This case is brought to you, Your Honors, today to resolve what we believe are three key issues. Was Mr. Sanceri in this case entitled to have his case dismissed from a violation of his right to a speedy trial as set forth in Doggett versus United States? And it is our position that the answer to that was yes, based on the four factors set forth in our brief. The second question is, can a violation of the defendant's right to a speedy trial, as set forth in Doggett versus United States, be a fair and just reason to withdraw a guilty plea under the totality of these circumstances, as set forth in Stevenson? Again, we will purport yes, primarily based on the same analysis from the first question. And is a violation of the defendant's right to a speedy trial, as set forth in Doggett versus United States, categorically waived when a guilty plea is entered? And it is our position that the answer to that legally would be no. In this particular case, we have the defendant, Mr. Sanceri, who was originally serving a sentence since 2016 on a different case. When he was in custody during that time period, a warrant was issued for his arrest on the case at bar. While he was serving his time in the Nevada Department of Corrections, there were no efforts underwent by the state or law enforcement to ascertain Mr. Sanceri's whereabouts or to take him into custody on said warrant. Approximately 2 years later, when he completes the sentence, 25 or 26 months later, as he is completing his sentence, he is set to be released. On the day he is set to be released to the public, he is then apprehended on the arrest warrant and then returned back to the custody of the state of Nevada to deal with the new charges. In that particular matter, Mr. Sanceri then quickly waived his right to a preliminary hearing to enter into negotiations, then quickly entered a plea. Shortly thereafter, Mr. Sanceri was deemed incompetent and committed for mental health treatment, and then was eventually found recompetent and then brought back. Upon his arrival, he then obtained new counsel, and after obtaining new counsel, at that point, the motion to withdraw a plea pursuant to Doggett, the motion to withdraw a plea was filed, and a motion to dismiss pursuant to Doggett was filed. The court, in making its decision, passed by a decision by this court in Zunza versus State that was issued during the time that this case was being heard, and that court did ask for supplemental briefing. That issue was then supplementally briefed. An evidentiary hearing was conducted where Metro was called to discuss their efforts, or as our brief set forth, non-efforts to ascertain where Mr. Sanceri was or to arrest him on that warrant. At the conclusion of that process, the district court then determined that Nzunza does not apply categorically in circumstances where a plea has been entered And in their minute order, it appears that they believed that the court believed that it did not have the authority to make that consideration. Before Your Honors today, it is our position that the court absolutely was obligated, as a matter of law, to consider those issues when assessing the totality of the circumstances in this matter. Specifically, in this particular matter, we are dealing with a situation under Doggett versus the United States where the defendant, had he not entered a guilty plea, would have been entitled to a dismissal under the four factors that are set forth in Barker versus Wingo, as then brought forth by Doggett versus the United States, and in this state, in Zunza versus State.
Mr. Sheets, if I can interrupt you for a moment, what was your understanding of what, if any, parameters the court gave on the evidentiary hearing, i.e., did the court allow for, but just maybe it didn't occur, the calling of former counsel to talk about alleged ineffective assistance issues, or it was solely about let's look into Metro's efforts regarding the warrant on the speedy trial issue?
To our knowledge, it was specifically limited to the efforts undergone by the Metropolitan Police Department and the state of Nevada to apprehend the defendant on the warrant. Alternatively, however, ineffective assistance of counsel is another basis for relief post-direct appeal through a post-conviction writ. So that remedy may still be available to Mr. Sinceri if that time were to come.
So are you maintaining that ineffective assistance of counsel would not be in an analysis for the court to go undergo for a motion to withdraw a guilty plea?
Not at all. It's our position that the court could definitely consider ineffective assistance of counsel when determining whether or not a guilty plea should be withdrawn. And as is fairly clearly set forth in a litany of case law on that particular subject. With that in mind, however, one of the factors for the court to consider is whether or not that speedy trial violation did occur. And where the state, I think, misplaces their argument, and I think the court erroneously, with all due respect to the district court, went with it, was concluding that because it's post-plea, he's waived his right to that speedy trial. And I think it seems very clear through the case law that is set forth in our brief, in Zunza in particular, Doggett in particular, we are dealing with the right of the defendant to invoke his speedy trial prior to his arrest on the underlying matter. And that's where it becomes very important in this case, because, of course, the defendant has entered a plea of guilty and then was quickly found incompetent. So we have real prejudice here. He was found incompetent as a result of suicidal tendencies and the mental anguish and the stress of thinking he's going to be released and then immediately being brought here to deal with charges that he did not know about. One cannot waive a right that he is not aware that he has. And that is where this court and the Doggett court have made it clear in terms of the right to a speedy trial. And if we're looking at...
I have a question for you on that point. Your written guilty plea agreement said that Sinceri understood he was waiving the constitutional right to a speedy and public trial. And we don't have a transcript of the plea canvas itself. And on its face, I appreciate the point you're making that it's different to say in the past there was a speedy trial act or speedy trial violation for the 2+ years delay in arresting him on the warrant and that this waiver doesn't reach that. But the problem is it's written so broadly. What was adduced at the evidentiary hearing that showed he did not understand that there was a speedy trial violation in the long delay that had occurred, as opposed to the prospective waiving the right to a speedy and public trial that would occur down the road but for his guilty plea? You follow what I'm asking?
I think I do, and please correct me if I go off on the wrong path. To our knowledge, the hearing itself, the evidentiary hearing, was specifically limited to the issue of Metropolitan Police Department's efforts to apprehend on the particular warrant. So that would have, in turn, limited our ability to examine the right as signed off. As we also note in one of the footnotes in our brief, Our office is not challenging that the court canvass the defendant consistent with the guilty plea, and therefore it's our position that the transcript would not be necessary because there is no challenge dealing with the canvass. However, a waiver of a right to a speedy trial, again, we're looking at, if we look at Doggett in a similar situation, that court made it clear in Doggett itself that the right is not known prior to the arrest, and that's the right that you can't waive. He could not waive that right prior to that time period.
So what, if anything, is there in the record to show that Mr. Sanceri did not know at the time he entered his plea that there was a potential speedy trial violation?
Well, I think it comes down to the evidence that he was committed because he did not know that the underlying trial, he did not know the underlying charge existed, and that's why Doggett, that's why Nzunza. You were unaware that you have a right when you are unaware that you are charged with the crime. That's where the analysis lies.
He's trying to withdraw his guilty plea. And as I understand it, the basis for trying to withdraw the guilty plea is that at the time he entered the guilty plea, he didn't know that he potentially has a valid basis for dismissal based on violation of speedy trial. Is that correct?
It is our position that because he had the valid basis for dismissal and the analysis as set forth in Stevenson, that the fact that there was a valid basis for dismissal pre-guilty plea, and quite frankly, it's our position to this day, that would be a fair and just reason for a defendant who has been...
If he didn't know at the time he entered his plea that that was out there.
I think what this court's doing, with all due respect, is swaying back towards that original, the original knowing involuntary language, which was expressly put aside in the Stevenson court.
Well, counsel, I'm well familiar with Stevenson. I'm the one that almost got reversed on that. But anyway, in talking about this, if he and his, let's assume for a moment, he and his then counsel knew we may have a basis to get the case dismissed, but they decide this is a good offer, let's take it anyway. You wouldn't suggest that there would then be a fair and just reason to withdraw the plea, would you?
I think there's a lot of speculation involved in that. Obviously, ineffective assistance of counsel is something that comes in the event this appeal were to not succeed, then ineffective assistance of counsel is an issue that could be raised in a post-conviction writ and could be brought forth in a hearing.
Just to clarify things here, and I think, and I apologize if I'm wrong, one of the things Justices Pickering and Kadish were getting at is what was in the record. And my understanding was Mr. Sanceri testified at the evidentiary hearing, even though it was kind of limited, as you say, to issues related to Metro's efforts to apprehend him. And he testified that his attorneys never discussed with him anything about his speedy trial rights or his rights to move to dismiss the charges.
He testified to that.
It was just that there was never any allowance of former counsel to come in and testify about those things as well.
I would agree. I think that Mr. Sinceri's testimony established the legitimate surprise that occurred when this case came about and the lack of the knowledge of his ability to have originally invoked that speedy trial right pre-arrest.
Okay.
And I think that in the record established that, and then the prejudice follows. I am out of time, so if I could, I would like
want
to step
reserve
back.
The rest of your time?
Yes, please.
Go ahead.
Thank you.
All right.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Christopher Lawley. I'm an assistant district attorney in and for the County of Clark, State of Nevada, and I am here on behalf of the state, the respondent in this matter. In this case, the defendant failed to meet his burden to show a fair and just reason existed to support the withdrawal of his plea. The more narrow question is whether the allegation that a Doggett violation existed would present a fair and just reason for the withdrawal of the defendant's plea. And I would submit to the court the answer is no. And I would also make the point that it is the defendant's burden in this matter to establish the fair and just burden. And I would submit, if you comb the record, nowhere in the record is there any suggestion of a limitation that was imposed upon defense counsel with respect to this hearing. There was no limitation. He could have called whomever he wanted. Under the Barker-Doggett test, which was enunciated in the state of Nevada in the Inzunza matter, the courts must weigh four factors: the length of the delay, the reason for the delay, the defendant's assertion of the right, and prejudice to the defendant. With respect to the first factor, the length of the delay, it must be presumptively prejudicial. And what the court in Doggett said is, as the delay approaches a year, you meet that threshold requirement. And that's exactly what this first element is. It is a threshold inquiry that centers on whether a Barker-Doggett analysis is appropriate. And the point was made clear in the Barker case at the United States Supreme Court, where they explained the length of the delay is to some extent a triggering mechanism until there is some delay which is presumptively prejudicial. There is no necessity for inquiring into the other factors. But in this case, we have a delay of 2 years. I would acknowledge that. And therefore, the analysis of the Doggett-Barker issue is appropriate. But also, it is important to keep in mind that the presumption of prejudice that is discussed in the first element of the test is distinct from the analysis of prejudice in factor four. The defendant conflates those two issues. His analysis is improper, and I will discuss that further. The second factor is the reason for the delay. And the defendant has failed to establish in this case that the state was the reason for the delay. Consider, for example, the facts in Inzunza. In that case, the victim's mother told the detective that Inzunza was living in New Jersey. She told the detective and actually provided the detective printouts from Inzunza's Facebook profile, which depicted a car with Inzunza's license plate on it, a photo of his work truck, the name and phone number of the business that he worked at. And there was testimony at the evidentiary hearing in that case from the North Las Vegas police detective who was responsible for the case. And the detective acknowledged it was not the policy of the North Las Vegas Police Department to follow up on warrants. He said he did nothing, quote, out of sight, out of mind, which is unfortunate. Let's look at the facts that were adduced at the evidentiary hearing in this case. The defense proffered a letter from the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department that was entered through a custodian of records. The Metro produced a letter which said, quote, there were no reports found within the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department pertaining to the attempted execution of the arrest warrant. And that's at volume 2, Bates number 153. There are no reports. What does that mean? That does not prove or disprove anything other than there was no report. Then, later on at the hearing, there was a discussion about P1. P1 is Metro's case management system. And detectives are allowed to enter notes into this system. Question by Mr. Sheets, and I'm referring to volume 2, Bates number 155 in the record. If there were notes in the computer system regarding an officer's attempt to pick up on an arrest warrant, that would be kept in your system? Answer, I don't know. I don't work with detectives. Later, another question. So if a detective enters into the computer system notes that they've made in an effort to pick up on an arrest warrant, that would be kept. Answer, if they've put them into P1, that in total is the evidence that somehow law enforcement failed the defendant in this case.
Is there any dispute that Mr. Sanceri was housed in the Nevada Department of Corrections during the entire time the warrant had been issued and was out there?
There is no dispute that he was in the Nevada Department of Corrections.
Any minimum effort running him through any system, find him? Ah, there he is.
Let me answer that this way. We did not hear the testimony of the investigating detective in this case. We were not allowed to ask, and there is no evidence in the record as to what he knew or did not know about the defendant. There is no evidence regarding Metro's policies related to what is required when you enter a warrant into NCIC. Are they required?
But Mr. Lawley, you have the testimony of Mr. Sanceri, and he says he was in custody the entire time, and at no time did anyone contact him, and did he have any knowledge of this criminal complaint having been filed or any arrest warrant out there? Isn't that sufficient to have it be incumbent on you to show efforts to serve the arrest warrant? I mean, he's in the custody of the state.
That is insufficient to warrant a dismissal of a case. We don't know, for example, whether there was in fact a search for the Nevada Department of Corrections inmate locator to determine whether or not that was done. We don't know because there was no testimony from the detective who may or may not have done that. Keep in mind,
it's kind of, we're looking at negligence. It's one of four factors. And to me, I mean, it's almost a res ipsa kind of situation. The state has the guy in custody and they can't find him to serve this. Isn't that at least enough to say in the absence of negligence that really wouldn't happen?
Justice Pickering, the difference here is that it is the defendant's burden to put forth the evidence, and there was no evidence one way or another that was adduced at this hearing. There was no evidence on the point.
Does circumstantial evidence work?
Pardon?
Does circumstantial evidence work?
It does, but there was no evidence. We don't know, for example, whether or not there was a search done of the Nevada Department of Corrections database at the time this warrant was entered into NCIC. Keep in mind, there was an extremely short...
Well, if they did, then they would have found him and then didn't go get him, which is worse.
Not necessarily. There was an extremely short period of time between when Mr. Sanceri was sentenced and when the warrant was entered. Is it possible that the Nevada Department of Corrections had not updated their records? It absolutely is. I want to move to the next factor of the assertion of the right. There's no question
Lally,
in this case.
Can I interrupt you for just
you
a moment?
You can.
I want to step back for a minute because, I mean, hypothetically, maybe you're absolutely right on the merits of a motion to dismiss for this. But my understanding is the district court didn't really get into the merits of the motion to dismiss and instead just denied it based on the plea agreement being in place. And the court's finding that because he waived his right in the plea agreement, the motion to dismiss was invalid, so it was denied. Right or wrong on that?
That is one interpretation of the record in this case. But I think if this court were to undertake an analysis under Doggett, a full analysis, you'll find that the defendant did not meet the requisite burden here to provide for the withdrawal of his plea. An essential element is the assertion of the right. And in this case, he specifically waived his speedy trial right. That's uncontroverted. It's uncontroverted that he did it. We don't have a plea canvas, of course, because the defense didn't bother to put that into the record. But it's uncontroverted that he waived his right to a speedy trial. And if you're concerned that he was not advised of the potential Doggett issue before he pled, that's an issue of ineffective assistance of counsel, which under Franklin versus State can only be brought in a post-conviction petition for writ of habeas corpus.
Well, so hold on. So I want to chat with you about that. I know, obviously, having tried the Mack case that I presided over, we've talked about Stevenson. It seems to me that this court has approved of the trial courts recognizing that ineffective assistance of counsel can be a component of a motion to withdraw a plea. I understand your position from the beginning today was that there was no parameters placed upon the defense. They could have called prior counsel if they wanted to, and they didn't. But I think that you can raise that issue in a pre-sentencing motion to withdraw a plea. You disagree with that?
I don't necessarily disagree, but what I can tell you, it was not done in this case. Okay. That was not raised as an issue, and so it's not respectfully appropriately considered at this point.
Well, if he entered... Well, so but hold on. Go ahead, Justice Pickering.
Yeah, I pulled up the transcript of the hearing where Mr. Sanceri testifies, and he does testify that he did not know when he signed that plea agreement about Doggett or the issues associated with that. He learned about that afterwards, after he entered the plea. And my reading of Stevenson is that the fair and just reason language comes from the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, was Rule 32, now it's Rule 11, fair and just. And they clearly recognize, as Stevenson suggests, that you can, prior to sentencing, move to withdraw a plea and have as part of the metric that you didn't understand or know what was going on. I mean, it's even a little broader than that, that you can have an ineffective assistance of counsel claim in that context without it having to go to a post-conviction habeas corpus writ. Do you disagree with that?
I do not disagree with that, but it was not done in this case. It was not, and if you look at the pleadings, it is contained nowhere in the pleading, so it was not an argument advanced. We know from Nzunza, Doggett, and Barker that prejudice is required. Courts look at the following harms that speedy trial rights were designed to protect against. One is oppressive pretrial incarceration. Two is anxiety and concern of the accused. And three is the possibility that the defense will be impaired. Let's consider the oppressive pretrial incarceration. The argument is that in booking the defendant on the warrant only after his underlying prison sentence was served, resulted in additional unwarranted incarceration. That's the argument. But that presumes that his lengthy criminal record, his numerous felony convictions, his eligibility for habitual criminal status, the egregiousness of the crime, when you consider all those things, that he would have received concurrent time. And that is not a presumption one can make here. In fact, the more likely result is that he would have received a consecutive sentence, and if so, there is no prejudice to him because he was not at liberty before the warrant was filed. Anxiety and concern of the accused, Mr. Sanceri testified that when he found out about the warrant, returned to Clark County, he became depressed. Is that fact sufficient to warrant a dismissal of this case? I submit that it is not, particularly when you consider the anxiety and feelings of hopelessness the victim must have felt when a gun was produced and placed in the back of his neck. The fact of the matter is the only potential argument is the length of the delay, which in this case was 2 years. And in Nzunza, this court said that a showing of actual prejudice is triggered when the delay is 5 years or more. That is directly from Nzunza. Here, we have a delay of 2 years. At most, if you give the defendant every benefit of carrying his burden at the evidentiary hearing, which he did not do, at most, the conduct of law enforcement was negligent, because the defendant was, in fact, in the Nevada Department of Corrections. Had they searched, they would have found him in minutes, which I think is a point that some were trying to make. This is precisely the scenario that occurred in Doggett, but the delay in Doggett, may I finish?
Yes.
The delay in Doggett was far, far longer than the delay that existed in this case. The delay in Doggett was 8.5 years. And if you consider a 2-year delay in the 8th Judicial District Court from your own experience as trial judges, that is not a sufficient period of delay when you consider the Nzunza requirement that the amount of prejudice a defendant shows is inversely proportional to the length and reason for the delay. A two-year delay in a case under these circumstances where at most law enforcement was negligent does not warrant a dismissal of the case. Thank you for extending my time.
Thank you. Mr. Sheets.
Your Honors, before getting to the main points of my rebuttal, I would note that in the Nzunza case, I would just ask this court to remind themselves of the length of the delay, the actual delay in that particular case. And it is far more similar to our set of facts than it is to the 5 years that the state would now put forth as being some kind of mandatory cutoff. I'm not going to belabor, Your Honors, with going through the transcripts of the hearing. It seems like you have a very good understanding of what occurred. You've seen it in my briefs. It's in the records. Justice Pickering has said the same. What I would note is that if we take the state's position today, and I'm going to focus more on the ability of the court to consider these issues and to consider Mr. Sinceri's testimony at the hearing, the state would have this court believe that I must have stated that I or counsel must specifically say counsel was ineffective. And if counsel is not raised, and if that issue specific of ineffectiveness is not raised, then you can't overcome the written part of a guilty plea and a presumed, and we are presuming a correct canvas, a presumed canvas on the issue. Outside ineffective assistance of counsel, you cannot You cannot overcome this signed guilty plea agreement. I think that that is wholly incorrect given the ruling in Stevenson. You can consider that you can, the district court has the ability for any reason, that's taken straight from the language of the case, for any reason to allow the withdrawal.
But I think, Mr. Sheets, the issue is that teed up for the trial court judge to even be considering at that evidentiary hearing, or is it solely the merits of whether Metro did what they were supposed to do in locating him?
Well, and it was our belief it was limited. Nonetheless, the testimony was adduced from Mr. Sinceri that he did not know, that he did not know that he was giving up that right. He did not know about Doggett. He did not know that it existed. So it was there. It was in the record. It was presented as evidence before the court. They had that to consider. They also had the underlying arguments with regards to Doggett, and prejudice is presumed after 1 year. It's very clear.
What do you do with the fact that the district judge's order has a footnote that says you didn't present the plea canvas test transcript to the district court, and the district court's discussing Padilla and other cases like that? The district court seems to be hesitant to credit your position that you should accept Mr. Sinceri's testimony at face value on what he knew and didn't know, because he didn't have that plea canvas, and the district court also didn't hear from Mr. Sinceri's prior counsel. I mean, there seems to be some confusion about what the scope of that hearing was.
May I continue? I'm over my time.
Go ahead. Thank you.
Could not agree with you more about the scope. It appeared that the scope was limited. The testimony was definitely offered, and our biggest concern, or the biggest concern of Mr. Sinceri here, is that the court may, given that same order that you're discussing, it's difficult to ascertain whether or not the court even said we're going to consider these issues as they pertain to Doggett and the motion to withdraw the plea and the dismissal, because if you were to believe the minute order, it certainly gives the impression that the court believed that because it was post-plea that it was prohibited from even undergoing that particular analysis. With regards to evidence that wasn't, may or may not have been presented, again, through the experience as trial judges, as the state would put it, it seems very clear in most circumstances that the state is the one who in these types of hearings will call prior defense counsel to rebut a claim of a defendant that he did not know or that he was not advised. The state did not bring forth prior counsel. They did not, to my understanding, subpoena or even reach out to prior trial counsel to come forth and provide that testimony. The state did not provide any testimony to rebut the testimony that was given as far as the Metropolitan Police Department, and proving a negative is difficult, and I think the testimony makes it pretty clear there's nothing there. And I think we're talking about far more than negligence. We're talking about gross negligence. And
okay,
I think
you're way over time.
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Appreciate the arguments today. We'll take this matter under advisement and in recess till the next call.